I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation.
Those are the words of Abigail Adams writing to her husband, John Adams, in 1776, while he and the other founding fathers were creating the new American government. John Adams would go on to become Vice President of the United States, and then President, and Abigail would become one of the most famous and eloquent first ladies ever. The woman reading those words is historian Lynn Withey. Former director of the University of California Press, Dr. Withey is the author of the best-selling biography, Dearest Friend, A Life of Abigail Adams, which first came out in 1981 and has remained popular ever since. Abigail Adams has been described as the most influential woman in revolutionary America. Her influence on John Adams was so great that she was known as Mrs. President. Among her beliefs was the notion that women's voices should be heard. Long before the terms feminist and suffragette came into common use, Abigail Adams was a champion for women. Listen and learn from Lynn Withey why Abigail Adams is one of Seneca's 100 women to hear. We are speaking today with historian Lynn Withey about the great Abigail Adams. Lynn, it's so terrific to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, we know that Abigail Adams was married to John Adams and was the First Lady of the United States from 1797 to 1801. She was a prolific letter writer and she was opinionated. For what do you think she should most be remembered today?
She's obviously most remembered by the public as an outspoken woman who spoke out for a more prominent position for women within their families, within their communities. It's debatable whether she really was arguing for women's rights in the sense that we think of it. But in any case, certainly she should be remembered for speaking out on behalf of women, and I would say secondarily for her role as the support for John Adams, both during the Revolution and then after he became president.
So what got you so interested in her?
Well, I'm a historian of the 18th century, and I had been doing research on communities in New England and read about her, of course, because, you know, if you study the 18th century, you can't help running across the Adamses and their contemporaries in the Revolutionary period. And at the time, I mean, this is a long time ago. This was back in the late 70s, early 80s. At the time, there had been very little work done on the history of women. It was a field that was just getting started. And there had been a couple of, I have to say, not very good biographies of Abigail back in the 30s and 40s. But at the time I started working on her, there had been no modern biography of her. So it seemed that she was due for a biography. And that's why I got into it.
Well, clearly due, particularly given who she was and what she did. I wonder, what was she like as a person? I mean, as you dug into her history and her accomplishments, what did you glean from that about her as a person?
Well, it's always a little bit dangerous to try to make judgments about people's personalities based on the written word. You know, it's one of the great disadvantages of doing history a time before recordings or before television and so on. But clearly she was a very, very intelligent woman, very determined, outspoken. She was also utterly devoted to her family, both her husband, of course, but her children, her sisters, her friends. She comes across as a very warm person, but also I have to say as a very critical person. She was opinionated and she was sometimes, I think, overly critical of people whose opinions differed from her own.
So to that end, she was called Mrs. President, and I gather that wasn't meant to be a compliment. Would you say that she was popular? Were some of her comments viewed as shocking to most women of the 18th century? Would they have been viewed that way? I mean, how much out of the lane was she?
Well, she was pretty far out of the lane for a number of reasons, not least that she was much better educated than most women of her time and traveled in wider circles, you know, national and international circles. I wouldn't say that she would have been seen as shocking because she never really deviated from the position of wife, mother, support. However, as I said before, she was really very outspoken. As far as Mrs. President, as far as being popular, I'm not sure that's even a question to ask, because at the time that John Adams was president, he was only the second president. The capital of the country was moving. It moved to Washington while he was president. The role of a first lady was not established at the time. The idea that a president's wife should have some kind of specified role was not at all clear. And I think the people that criticized her, in a way, they were criticizing John as much as they were criticizing her, because there were certainly people who thought that he was too much influenced by his wife. So yeah, there were people who thought that she was overstepping her bounds.
And that certainly is true to the present day in terms of first ladies being viewed as, some of them being viewed as overstepping their bounds. And it's also a role that's, it's, you know, one that comes merely by virtue of your marriage to the president. So it's a very hard role to define. But that said, did she not like the role of first lady? Do we know anything about that from your work?
Well, she professed to not like it.
Ah.
But I think she probably liked it more than she let on, just as she liked her time in France more than immediately after the revolution, more than she let on. I think she liked the public stage more than she let on. So there's a certain air in her letters, there's a certain air of protesting too much about the difficulties that she encountered. But fundamentally, I think she was a New Englander. She loved her home in Massachusetts and her family. And she didn't like being separated from them. And she really hated the criticism that was leveled against John. And of course, it's inevitable that a president is criticized. He was criticized even more than many presidents. He was increasingly unpopular during his tenure. And of course, he wasn't reelected. And so she was fiercely loyal to him. And she really hated being in the public eye and being criticized. But it was for him, not for her so much.
Mm-hmm. If you were going to compare her to a modern first lady, who does she most resemble, do you think?
Well, that's a hard one. I mean, Edith Wilson, who is maybe not modern by the terms of your question, Edith Wilson, because she took over for her husband when he was incapacitated, and she did it quietly, and she did it out of deep loyalty to him. And I can imagine that that's something that, under the different circumstances, I mean, it wouldn't have been possible at the end of the 18th century, but something like that would not have been unimaginable for her. Otherwise, I don't know, Nancy Reagan, I mean, for being very smart and very determined and a little sharp, would be the more recent first lady who comes to mind.
Well, she was clearly opinionated and outspoken. And I wonder if you could talk about that best-known comment of hers. In 1776, she wrote a letter to John Adams during the Second Continental Congress, as he and the other founding fathers were creating our new government. Could you tell us what she said in that famous letter?
"I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion, and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation." I think it's important to read that statement, which has, of course, is the most famous thing she ever wrote and has been subject to all kinds of interpretation. But I think it's important to see it in the context of her correspondence with John, which was very playful and humorous at times. And so there is it, and I don't mean to say that she's joking here, because she's certainly not, but she certainly doesn't really mean that the ladies are going to foment a rebellion. I mean, she's kind of playing into the language of the time. His response to her has sometimes been read as putting her down, shutting her down. And I don't think that's accurate. I think this was a kind of dialogue between them. But what I think she's after here is for women to be more fully recognized for their work, to have a stronger voice within their households and communities. I don't think she's arguing for women's rights in the sense that we understand it, or for the vote, which would have been unthinkable at this particular period of time. But I think you have to understand that this was written in 1776. It's after a period of more than a year when Abigail had been managing the home, managing the farm, because it wasn't just a house, it was a farm, and managing the children and dealing with the family financial issues and doing it very, very well, dealing in real estate stuff. I mean, she was taking on a lot of responsibility, and she knew that she could do it, and that she, in fact, enjoyed doing it, and that there was no reason why women shouldn't be able to play those kinds of roles that they were thrust into because of the war, but what would happen after the war. So that's what I think she's arguing for, a larger role for women, but within the confines of what was acceptable for women in the 18th century.
Seneca's 100 Women to Hear will be back after this short break.
Did she take a stand on slavery and racial equality?
You know, she doesn't talk about that. Obviously, she lived at a time when even in New England, slavery existed. It wasn't common. The Adamses did not own any slaves. And there was some incipient anti-slavery sentiment among some of the more radical proponents of the American Revolution. And she would have heard, I think, that. I think she would have been privy to discussions about that, but I'm not aware that it was a topic that engaged her in particular.
And she never wrote about that?
No, not that I've found.
And what about women's rights? Did she come out strongly in one way or another? I mean, did she have any connection to the suffragists who would come later?
Well, she felt very strongly about women's education. She thought that women should have better education, better opportunities for education. And she herself had a very good education because her father was a minister and taught her at home. I mean, she learned Latin, which was very unusual for girls at her time. But she didn't have any connection to the suffragists. Suffragists were a generation later. I mean, she died in 1818. And the people that we know as the founders of the suffragist movement, like Elizabeth Cady Stanton or Susan B. Anthony, they were born about the time that she died. Mm-hmm. So they're really another generation. I mean, the person who was most emphatic about women's rights in her generation was Mary Wollstonecraft, who was an English woman.
Yes.
So she doesn't have any direct connection.
Now, she kept up a correspondence with her husband's rival, Thomas Jefferson.
Yes.
And Jefferson went on to defeat John Adams in his bid for a second term as president. So what was the nature of their correspondence? What was that like?
Well, Abigail and John, too, for that matter, they met Jefferson. Well, John, of course, met him in the Continental Congress. But Jefferson was in Paris and was one of the chief negotiators with the French. And after the war, Abigail went, and John was also there for a period of time, and she went to France and joined John there. And that's where she met Jefferson. So they were all friends in Paris in these rather heady years of the end of the revolution when reforming diplomatic relations with the major nations of Europe. Now, that was a long time before the political rivalry between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. So when they ended up on opposite sides of the arguments about creating the federal government, there was a falling out, of course, between the Adamses and Jefferson, and they patched it up toward the ends of their lives. So there was a gap in the correspondence. And then later on, Abigail started corresponding with Jefferson again. And I think it was really that basis for friendship, those early years of the revolution never really evaporated. It overcame the political differences towards the ends of their lives.
And it was something deep that they shared in common.
It was, absolutely. Very warm correspondence late in their lives.
You know, as an historian, but particularly for purposes of this conversation, one who has looked deeply into Abigail Adams and her life and times and her accomplishments, what lessons do you take from her life?
Well, that's another hard question, because more than two centuries separate us, and there are really deep differences between her time and ours. So what I admire about her is her loyalty to her family and to her friends, and her willingness to stand up for her beliefs, to say what she thought without being too concerned about what other people thought of her. And I think those are qualities that serve one well in whatever time period we're talking about.
Well, I think that's so well said. Those are good ideas that we can all follow. And even though they took place so many years ago, two centuries, they still last. So thank you so much for this extraordinary conversation, for your work. Maybe you want to say something about your book or your other works?
Well, as I said earlier, I wrote this book a long time ago at a time when people were just starting to get interested in the history of women. And it was rather well reviewed, and it was really fun project to work on because she's such an interesting person, and her letters, I mean, she was a good writer. Her letters were so interesting. And then it had a second life when John Adams became a very popular topic, and there was a lot of interest in him, which is kind of surprising because he was not the more glamorous of the founding fathers. And so my book got reprinted right around, it was in 2001, my book was reprinted, and it had a bigger life then. And I went on from that. I mean, I've always been interested in biography, and I'm very much interested in this particular period of the late 18th century, which was, of course, a time of revolution, also a time of growing interest in science and the period of the Enlightenment. And so I went on and I wrote about Captain James Cook, and then I got interested in travel and so on. So my interests have branched out quite a bit. But this book, the Abigail Adams book, was my first book, published when I was very young, and it's lasted the longest, which has been an object lesson in how books can have a life of their own.
Yeah, and stood the test of time.
Well, that's true. And that's of course, very, very gratifying to a writer. But years later, someone still wants to talk to you about their book.
But it's also interesting that when one considers the history of first ladies in general, Abigail Adams, all those years and years ago to the earliest period of our country, always crops up in that pantheon of first ladies, you know, with the quotable quotes and the kinds of things that we've been discussing in this conversation.
Well, I think that's because she had a very strong personality, an interesting personality, and she was one who spoke up for herself. So she did not just stand in the shadow of her husband. So there's much to say about her and to appreciate about her.
Well, thank you so much, historian Lynn Withy, for bringing the great Abigail Adams to our attention in a way that perhaps we didn't know before we spoke to you. But it's been a fascinating conversation, and we're so grateful to you.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
What a remarkable woman Abigail Adams was. Her personality comes across even 200 years after her death. Here are three things I took from that conversation. First, despite constraints, women need to speak up and speak out. Abigail Adams lived in a society that didn't listen to women's voices, but she was determined to be heard, usually through her copious letter writing. Second, an independent mind is something to be valued. As Lynn Withy says, Abigail Adams was more than her husband's shadow. She could be highly critical of others. and it was thought that she often overstepped her bounds. She spoke her mind anyway. Finally, Abigail Adams treasured her friendships. Her deep connection to Thomas Jefferson survived the rivalry between her husband and Jefferson. Their correspondence transcended politics and endured. Tune in next week and hear about our next featured woman and discover why she's one of Seneca's 100 Women to Hear.
Seneca's 100 Women to Hear is a collaboration between the Seneca Women Podcast Network and iHeartRadio, with support from founding partner P&G. Have a great day.